Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we're in Provincetown for a conversation with authors Rebecca Mackay and Christopher Castellani, presented by 20 Summers at the historic Hawthorne Barn. Both authors discuss their latest novels, which capture pivotal moments in gay history. Mackay's The Great Believers, listed by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of 2018, is about a friendship and redemption in 1980s Chicago at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Castellani's Leading Men is a historical novel inspired by the romance between Tennessee Williams and Frank Merlo, set in 1950s Italy and modern-day New York in Provincetown.
Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you, Julie, for that, wherever she went.
Oh, there you are, right here. Perfect. You're right, perfect. Excellent. Now, you're a friendly face that we can focus on. For being here, and thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. Thank you all for being here. I want to echo what Julie said about this amazing program, this amazing series, this amazing space, and you're so happy to have us here. I am so thrilled to be here and so excited to, I finally have you all to myself.
Yeah, it's no, like, they're
so
not here.
Great. I'm so excited. I read and loved her book, and I'm so excited to talk with you. So the way it'll work is that we're both going to read briefly 10 minutes or so, and then we're going to have a very informal conversation. We have not planned anything.
And we haven't finished each other's books,
right,
for reasons we'll explain.
Yes. Yes. For very specific reasons.
So
we're going to have a very sort of informal conversation, but Rebecca, you're going to read first?
Yes,
okay.
That's the plan.
Excellent. So.
All right. Here's what I'm going to do. Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here. This is my first time in Provincetown. So, like, what?
The best place on earth.
And also, like, clearly, but also, like, to be here, like, here, doing this in this barn, like, the day before we launch this historic Pride Month. Mm-hmm. Like, and then also, did you guys know it's Walt Whitman's 200th birthday? I don't think he hung out in Provincetown, but still, like, that's, I'm still, okay. So because of all that, I'm going to read a section that I've never read before, also because I'm really sick of the sections I always read. But I have a Pride Parade section in this book, and it's kind of late. There are a couple spoilers, but I'll be careful about some of them. The great thing about reading something in public that I've never read in public before is I have no idea what I need to fill you in on beforehand, so I'm going to be interrupting myself constantly to give you information that you need. But the main thing here is it is the summer of 1986. We are in Chicago. My main character is a guy named Yale Tishman. He's in his early 30s. His world is both falling apart and taking on greater meaning in the midst of this epidemic as it circles closer and closer to him. And this is the one spoiler, is the fact that this guy named Charlie is his ex by this point in the book. He's not into Charlie's hypocrisy regarding safe sex that's going on. Charlie's going to be in the parade. And the other people you'll meet are simply friends of his. And then Harold Washington, who's mentioned toward the end, as I would hope you know, first black mayor of Chicago and I believe of any major American city. We just got our second last week. So, and Harold Washington, according to many, was gay, according to others, was not, but was definitely an ally until his untimely death in office. So, by the time he got to Clark, the route was packed and the first few floats had gone by. He wound his way behind people, looking for someone he recognized. At Wellington, he looked for Ross and his friends and their fire escape, but not too hard. After two blocks, he spotted Katsu Tatami across the street. And when a few people ran across behind the Anheuser-Busch float, he crossed too. He didn't know the guys Katsu was standing with, but Katsu was always good for a hug, an enthusiastic greeting. He had to shout in Yale's ear, "So far, so good. You want my soda?" He thrust a McDonald's cup at Yale, and a thought about germs flashed across Yale's mind, but he willfully ignored it. He took a sip and then wished he hadn't. Warm, flat sugar water. A bunch of Harleys rolled past, followed by a lesbian dojo, women kicking and chopping their way down the street, dressed in white. Miss Gay Wisconsin, earnest middle-aged women with PFLAG signs, a huge brass bed pulled by a convertible and occupied by two men making out with tremendous gusto, their torsos bare above a thin white sheet. This, all my research on this was YouTube-related. It was awesome. All right. Yale asked Katsu how he was, and Katsu said, "I'm becoming a legal expert." He explained, shouted, that he'd gotten new insurance 2 years ago. In January, he was feeling terrible and finally got tested, and he had it. Did Yale know? Yeah, he hadn't even told his mom, and his insurance was trying to claim that the virus was a pre-existing condition so they wouldn't have to cover it. Even though I got the insurance before the test came out, but they're claiming I should have known because 3 years ago I was treated for thrush one time, and that's enough for them to turn me down. He needed pentamidine treatments, and he'd need hospital care that wasn't at county, where he'd been a couple of times, and was Yale aware what it smelled like in there? There was a reason it was free. So Asher, this is their lawyer friend, was helping him apply for the Social Security he had to get before he could get Medicaid, because apparently that was how things worked in this stupid country. And do you know what I have to prove? Okay, this is insane. We have to prove I'm disabled, which I am now because I could work maybe 4 days a week, but the fifth day I get the runs so bad I'm glued to the bathroom floor. This was tenable for his part-time gig at Howard Brown, but not for the administrative assistant work that used to pay the bills and supply the useless insurance. But the runs aren't a disability category, you know? So Asher's finding me this junior litigator, and here's what he has to prove at this hearing. He has to show that I can't do any unskilled sedentary labor in the national economy, like the entire nation, and the examples they use. You want to hear the examples? Yale was exhausted just listening to Katsu, but sure, he wanted to hear. A drag queen passed on stilts in an elaborate Statue of Liberty costume, all green sparkles and gauze. Nut sorter. That's not a euphemism, by the way. Bowling ball polisher. Also not a euphemism. Silverware wrapper. Like sitting there wrapping silverware in napkins. Everyone wants their spoons handled by a guy with the AIDS runs, right? Wafer topper. I don't even know what that means. The last one, for real, is fishhook inspector in Alaska. They don't care that I can't get to Alaska and could never get this job. They care that it's a job in the national economy. So yeah, my survival now depends on proving I can't top wafers. Here came a bunch of guys in leather, a poster that read, "Bound up with pride." Some kind of garden club followed. But I'm going to get in on whatever clinical trials I can. And Asher's helping, Yale said. Yeah, Asher. He can sort my nuts whenever he wants, am I right? Yale felt his face catch fire. Yale has a huge crush on Asher. Oh, come on. You'd let him polish your bowling balls. Yale attempted a noncommittal laugh. And here, ridiculously, before he could properly recover, was Asher's AFC float. Here was Asher waving like a politician. Yale waved, but he didn't catch Asher's eye. Three guys on unicycles came next, cutoffs and denim vests, a series of aldermen and state senators in convertibles, most looking pained. The Out Loud float, and this is the gay weekly newspaper that is Yale's ex's paper. A red flatbed truck. Yale took a small step back so Katsu couldn't see his face, so he didn't have to worry what his eyes and mouth were doing. Poster board signs all over it. Fight Out Loud for safer sex. And Out Loud says, cover your head. Six beautiful shirtless men. Yale didn't recognize them except for Dwight, the copy editor. He couldn't see Charlie. And then suddenly he could. He had shaved his beard. He was the one holding the boombox that blasted, "You Spin Me Round." Yale tried to wrap his mind around the irony of the whole thing, but his body was busy reacting with some strange combination of high and low blood pressure. A Trojan hit Katsu on the chest, and he caught it, laughing, and handed it to Yale. He said, "I'm a lifestyles man, you want?" He stuck it in the pocket of his shorts. He'd need to get used to them. Until he'd redone the test in March, until Dr. Cheng had told them again that the ELISA was negative. Though this time he really had made Yale wait 2 weeks, as he'd vowed. Yale wished the Out Loud float would disappear, but it was still making its slow way down Clark. Someone scratched him between the shoulder blades, and he turned to see Teddy grinning, bouncing. "Look who came out of hiding," Teddy said. Teddy is a friend who is a philosophy PhD candidate. Yale should have known that Teddy might have been part of Katsu's group, and honestly, it was good to see him. Good, especially, that Teddy was talking as if he didn't think Yale was a monster for breaking up with Charlie. Yale told them about the Klan activity in the park. He said, "They're gone now. They didn't actually want to see any of this, you know? They left before the parade started." "What do they want, besides attention?" According to their giant banner, they want to quarantine the queers. Real original. Anyway, we yelled back for a long time, and these dykes made out right in front of them. And then they just packed up. I stuck around to talk to a reporter. Anyone want a hot dog? I'm starving. There was no point trying to move till the parade was over. And when it finally was, they followed the crowd to the park for the rally. Katsu took off, and Yale found himself alone with Teddy in an endless line for food. Yale said, I hope we're still friends. I was mad at you, Teddy said, but it was just temporary. I was judging you for being judgmental. Ironic, right? I'm not sure I was being judgmental. I know that for you, the news was Charlie testing positive, but for me, the news was him cheating on me. Maybe everyone else already knew, but I didn't. And things hadn't been great between us for a long time. The line lurched, and Yale made sure the guys behind them were strangers. He said, I feel like we're all caught up in some huge cycle of judgment. We spend our whole lives unlearning it, and here we are. The thing is, Teddy said, the disease itself feels like a judgment. We've all got a little Jesse Helms on our shoulder, right? If you got it from sleeping with 1,000 guys, then it's a judgment on your promiscuity. If you got it from sleeping with 1 guy once, that's almost worse. It's like a judgment on all of us. Like the act itself is the problem and not the number of times you did it. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, it's a judgment on your hubris. And if you got it because you knew you could and you didn't care, it's a judgment on how much you hate yourself. Isn't that why the world loves Ryan White so much? How could God have it out for some poor kid with a blood disorder? But then people are still being terrible. They're judging him just for being sick, not even for the way he got it. Yale tended to find Teddy mentally draining, but he was right this time. Way over at the bandstand, Mayor Washington had begun to speak. As a black man who has suffered discrimination, he was saying, as part of a race of people who have suffered. And Teddy said, he's a good one, yeah? We lucked out. So I'm going to read one more section. I always want to say, though, as in my acknowledgments, those are Harold Washington's words. That's my one act of plagiarism here, but it's acknowledged in the book. So every other chapter, and they're much shorter chapters, it's a much thinner thread that's woven through the novel, is the younger sister of one of Yale's friends who has died. We knew her in the 80s, in her 20s. It's 2015. It's 30 years later. She's in her 50s. And she's in Paris, and she's staying with a friend who has some photo albums from back in the day. She wasn't ready to look at them before, but she is now. And the one thing you need to know here is that in her adult life, she works, her job is that she manages a resale shop that benefits AIDS housing. If anyone knows Chicago, it's loosely based on the Brown Elephant in Chicago. There were 20 albums on the shelf, a fact Fiona hadn't absorbed that first day. Rows of black leather, brown leather, colored canvas. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw, when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater. Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terrence Robinson, Nico's Terrence, Jonathan Bird, Dwight Sumner. There were so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store. And then, when they discovered its mission, say something like, oh, I remember that time. Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. I knew someone whose cousin had it, they'd continue. Did you ever see Philadelphia? And they'd shake their heads in dismay. And how could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard? That they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust, a mass murder of neglect and antipathy. That when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here in her hand, a stack of ghosts. I will stop there.
You're listening to a conversation with authors Rebecca Mackay and Christopher Castellani, recorded at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more after a break. Welcome back to The Point. More now of a conversation with authors Rebecca Mackay and Christopher Castellani from the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown.
Okay, so I'll go off from that. I was making notes because I want to ask you about insurance and logistics and all that you had to research for all of that. And to say also that if you're going to have a conversation about insurance and all of that, where better to intersperse it than a pride parade, right? With all this going on, that was just a masterfully done just in terms of reader attention.
Like Statue of Liberty on stilts helps the
Exactly, right. So I'm just gonna read from the beginning of this novel, which I shouldn't have to set up because I'm reading from the beginning, but I will anyway, just to say that it's narrated by Frank Merlo, who was the partner of Tennessee Williams for about 15 years between the late 40s and the early 60s. This is set in the early 50s, and they're in Italy. So this is from chapter one, and it's called The Little Horse, which is the nickname that Williams had for Frank. Truman was throwing a party in Portofino, and Frank wanted to go. The invitation came in mid-July, slipped between parentheses and the long gossipy paragraphs of his letter to Ten, as if daring him to acknowledge it. Frank read the letter in Ten's absence. He'd been stuck for weeks in their stuffy fourth-floor apartment on Via Firenze, waiting for him to get back from Spain, while on the loud streets below, the real Romans escaped for the mountains. He replied to Truman with a brief telegram, and then he called the finest hotel in town, the Splendido, to book a room. He auditioned various linen jackets and swim trunks and hats in the mirror above the dresser, mended two pairs of Ten socks, and walked their silks down to the cleaners. When Ten returned home to find their bags lined up in the hall, packed for another trip, he didn't protest. He was sweet on Frank again after 3 weeks apart. A drive in the Jag up the coast of Liguria, far from the melting heart of the centro, could only make things sweeter. They took one last walk through the Villa Borghese. They followed two boys, the dark one, Tens, the blonde for Frank, down the Spanish steps and out the eastern side to the Corso, pulled along by the smoothness of their elbows. Not a hint of saggy skin on Tens' boy, his long arms tanned by lazy days on the beach at Ostia, or on Frank's, a Swiss. Who could say where the Swiss got that scar, new and pink across the knob of the elbow, or where he spent his own empty afternoons? Who could say he was a Swiss at all and not from some disappointing place like Minnesota? They could say, Frank and Ten, walking at a safe distance behind the boys, as they liked so very much to do evenings after dinner, those summers they lived in Rome, inventing lives for the Italians, inventing lives for themselves. It's what Ten was famous for. It was one of the many happy ways they passed their time together. They brought back the dark one, Mario, to Via Firenze, a Sicilian, like Frank, it turned out, but at least he was an American. As he hastily slipped on his espadrilles, color rising in his cheeks, Frank said to him, "You've just slept with one of the world's greatest writers." And because Mario had heard of Tennessee Williams, he stayed for the coffee and pastries Frank brought onto the terrace. Soon, Mario grew tiresome, as they all did, talking of his mother, who expected him home, who worried. There was always a mother. And they watched with relief as he and his tight elbows descended the stairs. He wasn't the first Mario, of course. Over the years, they forgot their names, but not their scars or their attitudes or the stories they told as they lay between them late into the night. Sometimes on their evening walks, the streets sultry and flickering with shadows, they'd spot one of the Marios in a piazza with his pack of friends, laughing, his arm slung over a girl's shoulder. If the Mario noticed them, he'd turn his face away or shoot back a look of defiance and shame and fear, which enlarged them. They left Rome the next morning. Truman had rented an apartment a few steps from the harbor above the Delfino restaurant, which Frank and Ten passed on their way up the hill to the Splendido. Ten paid the boat guy to carry their luggage, and when the hill got too steep, Frank grabbed the heavy case with the typewriter. He didn't like it when another guy did work for him that he could do himself, a guy who would have been him if he'd never left Jersey. The Splendido was first a monastero, the boat guy told him. And now, look at it. Che spettacolo, the place Clark Gable drinks his brandy to a view. Ten went straight to the desk as usual, and Frank arranged their dress shirts on hangers and brought their shoes down for shining and stole another hour for a nap. He'd never felt so tired in the middle of the afternoon, and he chalked it up to being 30. But it's possible, no doctor was ever able to tell him for sure, one way or the other, that the trouble had already started in his lungs. When he woke, Ten offered him a pill. Ten had as many pills as Italy had houses on the water. But Frank wasn't taking pills, not then. Instead, he smoked another cigarette and paid the boat guy to drive him over the mountain to Paragi Beach, where he swam to find his strength and clear his head. They didn't like Truman much, but Frank didn't hate him the way Ten did, or maybe Ten didn't hate Truman. It was hard to know for sure with Ten. It was a job in itself keeping track of who he was angry with and who was jealous of him, whose parties he was looking forward to, and whose they'd have to make up some excuse to get out of. Frank's official job was as Ten's secretary, but even his secretary didn't have a reason for being in Portofino other than to stop by Truman's party, and he didn't know when they'd be leaving. There wasn't much Frank knew in the summer of 1953, least of all how long he and Ten might last. At the Delfino, Frank lost track of him the first minute. Ten couldn't walk into a room without someone sweeping him up and into a crowd. How many times had Frank stood at the edge of the crowd, as if on a shore, watching him drift farther and farther out, his head bobbing on the waves, glancing back just once to meet his eyes? How many times had Frank found himself in an overflowing room like this one, greeting guests as they arrived, recognizing their faces from movies and the backstages of theaters? How many times had these people walked in, looked around, saw Frank, saw nobody, spotted a somebody over his shoulder, and then headed upstairs? A brass band started up. Frank danced with a French girl whose uncle watched from the bar. Girls liked to dance with Frank, and he with them. He had a way with a spin and a twirl and a catch and a bow, and this French girl, she could follow. That wasn't always the case with girls, even the fancy brought-up girls, but dancing with the clomping ones, even that was better than dancing with a guy, which he and Ten never did anyway, not with each other at least, not even in Provincetown. He saw the world like that a lot then, what he did with Ten, what he had done with girls. In those years, there was no such thing as early, late, or on time. They went from place to place on a magic carpet, dropped here, dropped there, women in electric dresses, men in monkey suits and bow ties made of white silk, cognac, cigars, wine, the sky turquoise, even when it was gray. Because Ten had no mind and little use for schedules and logistics and coordinates, he needed Frank to organize the day they woke to and the coming days and even the days before. The life of Tennessee Williams was a memory play in which memory was a jumble. It was bodies he remembered, bodies they remembered together, his body and Frank's, the Southern gentleman and the little horse, the bodies of all the Marios from Key West to Marrakesh. When it came to matters of the body, Frank and Ten trusted each other like soldiers.
So we're going to interrogate each other.
I know,
now.
Right? Now it's coming. All right, excellent.
So we should probably start by explaining why we haven't finished each other's books.
Right, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you want to go first?
Yeah. I mean, this is good because it means that we'll be really good at not giving spoilers.
Right. We literally can't give spoilers.
We can't because
we don't know how they end.
So for me, I've been like saving this book, and this thing happens when writing is your career of. You have to schedule your writing almost like when you were a student of, I'm doing this event, I have to read this, I have to blurb this, I have, and some, been so excited for this book, and I was like, okay, I'm going to read it this week. And I was so set, I checked into my hotel, I'm going to finish the last 50 pages, it's great. And I check my email, and I have this thing from one of the places I teach that's like, today is the last day to do your Title IX online video training. So I've been camped out in this gorgeous bed and breakfast on the bed.
You chose Title IX over my book.
I chose not getting fired or reprimanded by
that. That's fair. Yeah. That's totally fair.
So
totally
I was really bummed out, but tomorrow I get to...
Great.
And or the next day, yeah.
And Rebecca's book, which, of course,
I, like everyone else, has heard about and been dying to read. I had been listening to it in an audiobook. I was listening to it on Audible, and then I switched to Libro. You know about Libro?
No.
Oh my God, it's like the best thing ever.
This is the indie bookstore. Yes, this is what everyone should be doing.
If anyone listens to audiobooks, I highly recommend you switch to Libro versus Audible, because Libro supports independent bookstores, and Audible is an Amazon company.
Right, and if you read on an e-reader, you should get a Kobo, which supports indie bookstores rather than a Kindle. Yes.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that concludes commercials.
Yes.
But I was listening to it, and to say I was enthralled is not even close. I was there. I mean, I was at that parade. I was in the doctor's office. I was in Paris. I was in all of these places, and had the headphones around with me everywhere, driving everywhere, but always. And I was so, I got to chapter 45 of, I've told Rebecca this already, but I got to chapter 45 of 47, and they're in alternating chapters. Fiona has a chapter, Yale has a chapter. And I knew I sensed that the last two chapters were going to be one, the last one from Yale and the last one from Fiona. And I just couldn't do it. Like, I just couldn't do it, because I wanted to live in a world in which Yale in particular was still alive, you know? And I just couldn't.
Well, he doesn't know. He doesn't read it.
And so I have not, to this day, I actively have not finished the book, which I feel sort of guilty about, but I hope you know it's out of respect.
No. It's all good.
But I was thinking of the end of that, which I just remembered today, the end of that Susan Sontag story, The Way We Live Now, and that iconic story in the 80s, that came out in the 80s, I believe, about the AIDS crisis, and what's told from 26 points of view, right? Each person with a different name, starting with different letter of the alphabet, and kind of mirroring in a way that circle of friends that you have in your book, with all these gay men who are all constantly talking to each other and checking in with each other. And the last line of that story is something like, if I say he's still alive, he's still alive. And then someone else says, he's still alive, right? And so that's kind of the relationship I have with that book.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Yes,
thank
of course.
You. Okay, here's what I want to ask you.
Okay.
bringing, lightening things up a little bit.
Okay. Yeah.
We both started our books with parties, which is the worst idea. It's so hard.
Right.
It's not that it can't work, but it's so hard.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it's an opportunity to introduce your reader to a scene because everyone's coming in and out, et cetera. You're also juggling so much. Mm-hmm. And, your primary task as a writer in the first pages of any piece of writing is to orient the reader. Mm-hmm. And throwing them into a chaotic party scene is perhaps not the wisest way to do that.
Right.
And we both took this on. I would like to believe it works for, I know it works for yours. I would like to believe it works for mine.
Definitely works for yours.
So, what were we thinking? And
right.
then was that like, or did you not struggle with that at all? Was it totally easy?
Well, in a weird way for me, I'm making a bookmark for later for you to talk about healthy terror. Because this is a thing I heard you talk about, which is so important for writing. But I kind of actually did not have a healthy terror about this scene because in the summer of 53, Truman Capote did invite Tennessee Williams and Frank to his party in Portofino. And I know that invitation was extended. I don't know whether Williams and Merlot actually went to the party. I do know that for there a couple weeks after they got that invitation that are missing from Williams's journal. Not like torn out. I wish it would be more dramatic if it was like torn out. But he just doesn't make any entries in those weeks after. And so the sort of launching point for the book is that Frank and Tennessee go to Truman's party. There they meet another male couple, two men who are in a relationship. One is a writer and one is not. And they meet this fictional actress and her mother. Or it's not an actress yet, but they meet a fictional mother and daughter. And so it almost wrote itself in the sense that I knew that I had to start the book with all these characters coming on stage at the same time. And I also, because this sort of thing like pleases me, I also like to think about it as a play. Since I'm writing about Williams, that in the kind of traditional play, everybody's sort of on stage in the first act, and we get to meet all the characters, and then things sort of play out from there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought I had no choice but to start with that. But I actually had the same question for you about that party scene, because I wondered, because I know the book didn't start, or maybe I'm wrong, but you said the book didn't start with the men, right?
My writing started with that scene, but my idea of it started with this other, this sort of subplot about this woman who had been an artist's model in World War I era Paris, who's in the world. Yale is the development director for a small art gallery. He's got this elderly donor giving art pieces. She was a model. I need a, like a long marination phase when I write. One of the things that happened was I had this idea originally that this is going to be this woman. I wanted her looking back from the end of her life. So this is what put it in the 80s.
Right, okay.
Originally. And then I was, you know, it's like, okay, she's going to be dealing with an art guy. This is an opportunity to be writing about the AIDS epidemic, which is something I've been wanting to write about for a long time. But it was really going to be her story. And my original idea was she was going to be sitting at home and watching the news, and a painting would come up on the news of sort of dubious authenticity. People didn't know if it was from this famous artist or not. And she knows because it's a painting of her. And she's trying to contact people in the art world and tell them this. And I was really plotting it out mentally for a long time, thinking about it. And I was about to take off for an artist residency in Wyoming at UCross. And the day before I left, my husband asked me about what I was working on. And I told him this whole idea about this woman. And she sees this thing. And he goes, honey, you know that's the plot of the movie Titanic? But then they bring up that sketch, and she's like, that's me, and I shall tell
you. And you're like, yeah, it did really well.
I know, right? Right? $1 million, so like, leave me alone. No, I was like, oh my God. And I had to rethink a lot, which was good. But I was starting to see these really interesting parallels between the World War I generation and the AIDS generation.
Yes, yes.
What we know as the lost generation because of the aftermath.
Right.
Because, you know, World War I and the influenza of 1918 decimated that generation largely of its young, able-bodied men.
Mm-hmm.
And in a city like Paris, where people had, you know, it was the age of the Art Academy, where people had been coming from all over, finding chosen family, and then this happened. The parallels between that and the city like Chicago in the AIDS generation were becoming very, very striking to me. So I was starting to find the book. So by the time I sat down to write, I was deep into my research, and it was like, okay, I'm going to start with this party scene.
But the idea of like being at the party and then him, he comes down and everyone's gone.
Yeah.
Like that to me was, it was both like a great plot device in the sense like, where are they? But it also was, of course, the perfect, in a way, a perfect metaphor for the crisis itself, right?
Right.
Everyone is gone, you know?
Right.
And I mean, so I don't know how, like, was that part of the thinking, or just did it, or happen organically?
You know, it
like
was,
that?
I had a nightmare.
Yeah.
I was working on this. I had a nightmare. It was me in the nightmare that I'd somehow fallen asleep upstairs at a party. And I came down and I was trying to sneak out of the house and get all my stuff and leave, you know, without waking up this family. And it was one of those ones that really stuck, you know, kind of all day. And I don't think I'd even thought of the party at that point, but I was like, I think this is something. I think that that feeling of eerie aloneness is something that I want to use. And it ultimately, you know, I think that it's playing a trick on you in some ways, because it seems like, it might seem like it's going to work as a neat allegory in terms of who survives,
for one thing.
Right. Also in terms of maybe that party being a set piece and you don't need to worry about what actually happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually there's a lot of cause and effect that I wove into there that a lot of stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what's weird about that scene is, so basically what happens is, if you haven't read it, there's a kind of a memorial party for someone who died a few weeks back, long story, and Yale goes upstairs to rest because he's not feeling well. When he comes back out, everyone is gone and he has no idea where they went. And there's a logical explanation. But very often when I read to a crowd, I read the end of that first chapter, sort of ending with him wandering around this empty house.
You're listening to a conversation with authors Rebecca Mackay and Christopher Castellani, recorded at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. More after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. More now of a conversation with authors Rebecca Mackay and Christopher Castellani at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown.
You were trying to work on this, or starting this years back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it that you weren't ready to tell this story, or was it that you just hadn't caught the right end of it yet?
Both, I think. Yeah, I think, I mean, I knew who Tennessee Williams was, obviously, and I probably read Glass Menagerie or seen Streetcar or something like that. But it was the late 90s, and I was in a used bookstore in Delaware, where I'm from, and I'm super cool, so it was a Friday night, and that's what I was doing. I was in a used bookstore.
Yeah.
I absolutely remember very vividly that I was like, I had no life, so I was in the used bookstore and just sort of like, or I had the best life, depending on how you think about it, right? And I saw the memoir by Dotson Rader called Tennessee, Cry of the Heart, and there is, I'm a sort of generally a melodramatic person, and that just that title, Tennessee, Cry of the Heart, and then this photo of Williams on the cover of that book, sort of shirtless, like kind of holding himself and looking into the distance. I was like, that's the book for me. Like, you know, and so I started reading it, just expecting to know, to learn something about Williams. Again, I remember it so vividly. I opened right to the scene in which this guy named Frank, who I didn't know anything about, was dying in a hospital, a cancer ward at Memorial Hospital in 1963, waiting for Williams to come and visit him one last time. And I learned from the memoir that he was this working class Italian guy who had been Williams's partner, and that they had been estranged by the end, and that according, you know, to the author, all that he wanted was to see, was for Williams to visit him. And again, my melodramatic self just really immediately identified with that, with the pathos of that, the pain of that, and also, of course, with the fact that I was a working class Italian-American guy from Delaware, just a couple hour, you know, a couple hours south of where Frank was. And I was like, how did this guy, what was their relationship like? How did this guy end up being Williams's partner? What was their life like together? So I immediately just I knew I wanted to write about them somehow. But I actually didn't know then that you could put real people into a novel. I thought I'd have to write a biography. And I wasn't a nonfiction writer. So so I had no interest in writing a biography. So I kind of set it aside. And then I saw the film Gods and Monsters, which is one of my favorite films. And then I read the book. And I thought, wait, oh, you can put real people into a story and make it fiction. And so I tried a bunch of things, and I'll spare you all the iterations of this novel. But it was two major things happened. One was I realized I had to tell the story from Frank's perspective, that it was actually not about Williams. It was about Frank, and it was about their relationship. Like, to me, Frank is the main character. Their relationship is the second most important character, and then there's another character as well who informs them all. And so once I kind of figured that out, because I realized that I have nothing to add to our understanding of Tennessee Williams as a character and as a writer, as a playwright, but I felt like I had something to add to our understanding of their relationship and our understanding of Frank. So I knew that I'm never in Williams's head in this book. Anyone who wants to read this to figure out more about Williams, I feel like I'm not in his head. It's really about Frank.
Yeah, I think it's also about the atmosphere that they're existing in, right? Yes. There's so much just about that world that you can then extrapolate. You know, if you're into Tennessee Williams, you can kind of learn, okay, this was the planet he lived on, and here's,
right, and I wanted to, you know, again, like you did, try to recreate their set, you know, like who they hung out with, who they were, you know, bitchy with and catty with, and who they were friends with, and who attracted them, you know, and which is why I landed on this aspiring actress, because for the longest time, the novel, and I think you'll appreciate this, for the longest time, the novel was, one of the iterations was Frank telling his side of his relationship with Tennessee, and then this other guy named Sandro telling his side of his relationship with the writer John Horne Burns. How many people have heard of John Horne Burns?
Only from your book.
Right, only from the book, right? Yeah, I mean, there was a time when he was the great American writer.
Wow.
I mean, like, this novel called The Gallery came out in the late 40s, early 50s, I forget exactly. He was hailed as the next great American writer, and then his next two novels flopped.
And then he died very young.
And then he died very young, 10 days after this party at Truman Capote's place. So I located them there, and I was going to tell Williams and Frank's story from Frank's perspective, Sandro and John Horne Burns' story from Sandro's perspective, and it was going to be like a compare-contrast. Like, you know, like, so they're like this, and they're like that. And I realized kind of way too late.
Like the term paper writes itself.
Yeah, that compare-contrast is not a plot.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm like, wait, this is actually not a novel. This is just my own kind of, like, this is what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. So that's when I had
the
to kind of figure that
the 11th grade English teachers of the world, though,
right?
Would eat that.
Right? I know. And I was one of those. I taught that, so it makes sense that, yeah.
You
taught
11th grade?
I taught, yeah. I did 11th grade high school.
When? How long?
Just for a year, actually.
Yeah.
Right after after college. I taught high school English, public speaking, strangely enough, and a couple other things.
No way. So this is maybe, maybe this is a weird, we're going to get back to the books, but we should talk about teaching, because there is this weird thing of, we have these parallel jobs in different cities. And I think we both ultimately, I think there are many writers teach because they have to, either to earn a living or just, as a writer, you get brought into some university, you're supposed to give a lecture. But I think we genuinely both really love teaching, or we wouldn't be in these positions. And like, you taught high school, I taught elementary school for 12 years. Before my first novel, or until after my first novel came out. And does it mess you up? Your writing, does it mess your writing up? Not you as a person.
Well, the advice I usually give to aspiring writers is actually to teach as little as possible, or to teach in a way that is contained, right? Because I love working with aspiring writers. I love helping them. I love all of that. But I feel like we each get a limited number of words that we can deal with every day. And if I spend all of my time working with other students on their words, I feel like I don't leave enough for myself. Because also, like you, I just throw myself into their projects. Like, they become my projects. Like, I have to help them make them as good as they can possibly be.
Yeah.
And I just don't have enough left over for myself. But it's so satisfying that I like to do it, but it has to be contained.
Yeah.
You know? And so I've, like you, have found a way of both being in the writing world and teaching some and doing other stuff that's more administrative.
That's the thing.
Yeah. But I always come back to teaching because I do feel, this is such a cliche alert, that I do feel like I learn so much from both their mistakes and also the things they do narratively with plot, with character, with structure, with all those things. I learn from them. And so it becomes really, I can't think of ever giving it up.
No, I can't imagine.
Yeah, do you feel
because for me, and my thing, same administrative role, and then I teach this year-long novel course, and it's for people starting novels. So I only read about 100 pages of their work, which is again, limited, contained, good thing.
Right.
But I've been doing it for 9 years now, and at the beginning of every class, we basically have group therapy. We go around, how are you doing? What's happened since last month? What have you written? And they, the things they're struggling with come up. And it's really cool for them to hear that someone else is struggling with the same things. But for me, it's 9 years in a row of 12 students each time, 12 times nine, whatever that is. They all go through these cycles of getting allergic to their own work and these crises of faith and then coming back to it. There's a point midway where you're like, wait, who's telling, what are words? What even are, who's telling this story? Did someone, there's this kind of hyper self-awareness that happens midway.
Absolutely. But it can be, I do worry about getting too much, too involved in it, because it does kind of, I don't know. But it does also open all these possibilities.
So. Yeah. Well, there are times at the end of the day, it's like, I've been reading student work all day. I've been writing if I can. I've been dealing with emails. And I fall into bed, and it's like, there's a great novel on my bedside table. And it's like, I should really read that.
Right.
Should we talk for a second about setting? Does that...
I just rambled on, so it's your turn.
Well, we can both talk about it. No, I think that... I think it's always, it's interesting when a setting really works, people tend to talk about the setting as a character, which I think is a way of just sort of trying to understand it as a force. And I think that's really valid. I also think that's what we should really just talk more about setting. Like, this is what setting should do, right? We shouldn't have to be looking at it through it's almost like a character. It's a setting. It is... and a real setting.
It's context.
It is acting upon the characters. The characters are acting upon it. And unlike you, I love my city. Maybe you should move to Chicago, Chris.
I love Chicago.
Come live in Chicago. But writing this transformed the city for me. I kind of alluded to it before, but at the time the book starts, I was 7 years old. So I was around. I remember Chicago in 1985. I remember a very different version of it. I was not hanging out in Boys Town, sadly, at age seven. It was like the museums in my parents' office, and it was that version. We lived in the suburbs. But I had no idea that I was walking through historical sites. like that. You know, you hear things of like, oh, okay, this is where like the first fur traders got off the boat and fought a bear and then they whatever. And it's like, okay, great. Yeah, you can, isn't that cool? You're walking by a skyscraper. This is where the last bear was killed in Chicago. It's like right downtown. But in terms of battles that were fought in my lifetime by people in some cases who are still alive in places that you could walk past or drive past every day and have no idea. And Chicago has done a better job than many cities in commemorating some of those places. We have an amazing LGBTQ history walk on North Halsted now. There's work that's being done much more than in some places. But the places, you know, I wrote at great length, there's a whole chapter set at the 1990 National ACT UP demonstration that took place in Chicago because the American Medical Association and a lot of insurance companies were headquartered there. And also the pharmaceutical company that came up with the HIV test, although then they also were doing AZT and making it cost $700 a pill, so they got protested too, for good reason. But so a lot of reason for everyone to come to Chicago. And this all took place right downtown, right at the county building, and people were out on this ledge of the county building unfurling this banner and clinging onto the sides of the building as they're pulled in by the legs by these police officers. Mm-hmm. And this was the other thing that I my research was YouTube-based. Someone had a shaky camcorder out there in the streets. The video cassette sat in someone's basement for 30 years, and now it's on YouTube. Mm. This is a building I've been past a million times. And, you know, I go past it now, and, you know, I stop and I look and I get chills. And this is, you know, what you would feel walking through a Revolutionary War battleground, you know, this and it means as much. And I, you know, there were five men who were out there on that ledge with the banner. And I didn't realize until late in my research that two of them were still alive. And one of them ended up sitting down and talking with me, this guy named Billy McMillan. I felt like he'd stepped out of a history book. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It's just that I'd been studying him in this context. There was a photo that included him that's been the wallpaper on my laptop for 5 years now. And I was really embarrassed, but I showed it to him, and he's like, "That's weird."
Yeah. Stalker much? Yeah.
But then he's telling me of like who everyone else in the photo was, and he's like, "Oh, he was so cute. I don't know what happened to him. I was sleeping with him. Like, it was amazing." Perfect. But you know, it transformed the city. And one of the absolute best things for me that's come out of this book is, you know, there are things, you know, I didn't realize. I knew there was a lot of ignorance out there. I did not realize how very much ignorance was still out there among educated people until this book came out. And I'm hearing from well-educated women, say in their 60s, going, "I had no idea I was raising my kids in the suburbs. And I didn't understand." Wow. Younger people who just don't understand. The number of books, and this has been like the greatest honor, the number of books I've signed, older gay men have had me come and sign a book for a younger gay friend. Mm-hmm. They're like, "He doesn't get it, he needs to," you know. Mm-hmm. But along
There's
with
a whole
that,
other conversation we had about
oh my
the
God.
Age of prep that we're in and,
oh
and all the things that's happening now. That's a totally different conversation.
Well, and the ignorance, yes. I mean, oh my God, the right, number right. of times, this is worse because it's like, readers at least are kind of smart, but when you're just at a random party and someone's like, "What do you write?" And you're like, "I wrote a book about the AIDS epidemic in Chicago," and they're like, "Oh, isn't it great that it's cured now?"
Oh
and you go,
God. "Yeah, oh my God, yeah,
that would be fantastic." Right. But no, and they're like, "No, because of magic, because you know Magic Johnson."
Oh my God, oh my God,
and the flames.
Yeah, yeah right, right.
Anyway, yeah, like I'm gonna bring this party down real fast.
I know, right?
Like,
yeah, seriously.
Sit down.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know how to bring it back up. After
no,
that.
Right. But my point being, along with all of that, people in Chicago, who whatever level of education they had about the AIDS epidemic, starting to understand with me, you know, I'm just beginning to understand this too, but the people who hadn't lived through it, understanding the map that we're walking over and the sacred ground we're walking over.
The 20 summer season runs through mid-June at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. You can find out more information about upcoming performances at 20summers.org. Today's show was recorded and mixed by Brian Morris. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.